Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program here in the middle of the week. It is Ask Anything Wednesday. We'll look forward to your questions, and it's just good every week to find out what America's talking about. And in particular, since this is the place for intelligent Christian conversation about the things that matter, I'm really interested to find out what's going on in terms of conversation in your house, perhaps over your dinner table, at your workplace, in your local church, on the college or university campus. Just give us a call. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is a big day, of course, in the news. Yesterday, the 2009 fall elections took place. Big elections, of course. The center of the nation's attention was the state of Virginia and then the state of New Jersey. Gubernatorial elections there. Republicans picked up both of those races. In Virginia, it was a rout. It was the kind of landslide you do not often see, especially when there's an incumbent that is on the ballot. But Bob McDonnell there won the popular vote, 1,158,000. That's 58.6%. That's almost 59% of the voters who went to the polls there in Virginia over Creed Eads, by the way, the 41%. You start looking at this, you realize that's huge. Virginia is one of those states that is a bellwether. There is no doubt that it is one of those states that could go red or it could go blue. By the way, it's also one of those states that shows you how a transitory America, just population shifts, can really change the political landscape and the cultural landscape of a state. Virginia has been for many years an agrarian state. And as an agrarian state, it has been one of those places where you would just put it in the red category. And it has been that way for many years. But it has always had there in Northern Virginia and around, for instance, Charlottesville, areas that were not so conservative, and it all depends on who gets out to vote. Very interesting maps were shown last night indicating that the red-blue shift was pretty pronounced there in the state of Virginia. In New Jersey, there's the bigger surprise. Candidate Chris Christie was elected the governor of that state with 48.9% in a three-way race. Independent Chris Daggett received 5.7%, but the incumbent, John Corzine, received a popular vote that amounted to right at 45%. Pretty devastating for an incumbent Democratic governor. New Jersey is bigger news in terms of the surprise than was Virginia, but Virginia just might be the bigger news in terms of the bellwether, the indicator status of that election. But of course, those of us who are concerned about marriage, well, we had all eyes on Maine. There, it was very interesting, and a lot of folks in the national media forgot to keep asserting what was actually going on in Maine. What's going on in Maine was this. The voters there were repealing a legislative act signed into law by the governor of that state that had authorized the legalization of same-sex marriages. So it wasn't that the citizens of Maine were going into the voting booth just to say, all right, in a hypothetical, do we want to approve same-sex marriage in order to, for instance, influence the legislative process or to enact that by referendum? They had to reverse an action taken by the legislature. They had to reverse a bill that was signed into law by their own governor. So you start looking at that momentum and you realize that there was also the confusion of people having to go into the voting place to vote for a repeal. That's as one of those, you have to vote positive for a negative. That's confusing to voters. And so a lot of folks who cared about marriage said, we're really under the eight ball there in Maine. Folks are going to have to really be alert and know what they're doing. The polling was very interesting. And by the way, one of those things that we learned from this is that the pro-marriage vote under polls, which is to say it looked right at 50-50 going into the election yesterday, and yet it wasn't 50-50. The voters of Maine stood up for marriage. They made a very clear statement of their support for marriage as the union of a man and a woman, and 53% of voters approved the repudiation of the action taken by the legislature and the governor of that state. So as same-sex marriage was about to become law in Maine, it now will not become law. And folks, that's really big. It's big in a whole lot of ways. This doesn't mean that the battle for same-sex marriage will be abandoned by those who are pushing it. It doesn't mean that the battle to protect and preserve marriage is over, not by a long shot. There are huge issues before us. The biggest is the generational shift, just in terms of the fact that younger Americans seem to be far more accepting, if not supportive, of same-sex marriage. But it does tell you a whole lot. One of my favorite statements about this came from a proponent of same-sex marriage from California, who said, if you can't win on a vote like this in Maine, you can't win nationwide. Now, one of the things to note, by the way, is that now you've had a very liberal state. By any estimation, California is one of the most liberal states in the union. Just look at its presidential election pattern. But the voters of that state really overwhelmed a great deal of momentum coming from a state Supreme Court decision and stood up for marriage back in November of 2008. Now, across the nation, across the continent, indeed, on the other coast, the voters of Maine have done the same thing. And even though the voters of Maine are much outweighed in population by the voters of California, the signal they're sending is just about the same. And it's just as important. Very, very interesting. By the way, right now, it looks like in Washington State, where Referendum 71, known as the Everything But Marriage Bill, is now very much up in the air, it looks like those who have supported this almost same-sex marriage bill are claiming victory. However, it is so close, it is still not known. And yet, I have to say, just in terms of intellectual honesty, I think it's important to say that those who wanted to see a major statement in defense of marriage there in Washington State are disappointed. The fact that it is even this close, much less the fact that it could have been lost, that's pretty important. Now, one of the things you need to note there is, I mentioned in Virginia that the voting pattern is not just what happens in a state. It's not like in every precinct, 55 or more percent voted for one candidate versus what you find in the other, where in that case, by the way, it was 59% and 41%. It wasn't evenly distributed across the state. Precinct by precinct, there were incredible divergences and contrasts. But it's really looking at Northern Virginia as blue, using the media coloration of our cultural divide now, and the rest of the state is red. In Washington, it's very much the same way. Voters were soundly rejecting same-sex marriage throughout most of Washington, measured geographically. As a matter of fact, virtually all of eastern Washington was solidly against same-sex marriage. But what you needed to watch is where the voters were concentrated, and 30% of the voters in Washington State live in King County, home to Seattle, and there the initiative to expand the state's domestic partnership law was winning approval by nearly 2-to-1 margin. So when you're thinking political strategy, and that's a part of the great game of politics, you need to recognize it's not just voters of a state that matter, it's where they are in a state that matters. And, of course, you're looking at a media influence here. And so there's a media market in King County reaching metropolitan Seattle, Tacoma, and elsewhere. And, well, any way you look at it, history was made yesterday. And the unfolding of this will continue for some time as we await final reports coming from especially the state of Washington. But isn't it interesting to listen to all the speculation about what this means, looking ahead to 2010, looking ahead to 2012. I think it's really interesting to imagine that the great game of politics so consumes some people that they live by this. Indeed, they live for this. And it's just a reminder to me that even as we affirm over and over again that Christians have a political responsibility, and I think that should be beyond debate, there is a political responsibility in a land where we are given the right to vote. A decision not to vote amounts to a vote. There is no way out of that political stewardship. The issue is whether or not we as Christians are thinking as Christians and voting as Christians, connecting the dots to the issues and operating out of a Christian worldview. But even as we want to affirm over and over again that political responsibility for Christians, we need to be really careful that we do not invest the wrong kind of hope in the political process. At the end of the day, in a fallen world, government is important. It is important in order to maintain order and to fulfill certain responsibilities that God has invested in government. It is important that governments do their very best to seek to uphold justice, to seek to organize a system of law that is fair and just, that keeps order in the society and leads to human flourishing. But government cannot add meaning to an individual's life. Government cannot solve the sin problem. Government cannot make people better. It can make people behave, but it cannot make people better. It cannot make them morally improved. So even as you look at the results today and imagine all the speculation, and even as you see all the political consultants, they're packing their bags to get to the next client, focused on the next election. Just remember, we're going to be at this political game one way or another till Jesus comes. The big issue is, as we always know, whether, when he comes, he finds his people faithful. I'm really thankful for what happened in Maine. I imagine there are an awful lot of people in Washington and beyond who are really interested in what happened in New Jersey and Virginia. As important as that is, and I want to affirm again and again how important that is, what happens in your family's life, in your marriage, and in your local church is actually more important. Responsibility starts there and flows out. We'll be back to talk about what's on your mind for Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Miller Program. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with your calls.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. It's Ask Anything Wednesday. We're glad to talk about what's on your mind. We were glad to get a call from Stephen, who was unable to stay. His question was, what are your thoughts about taking out debt for college? Does Scripture speak to this? Scripture certainly speaks to being wise in terms of stewardship, financial management, savings. It speaks of actual investment and of the wisdom of being prudent with finances. You know, I think I'm in an unusual position to speak to this. And as a college and seminary president, I really believe in education. Education costs money. There's no way around it. And there is an investment and reward formula that's very much in your mind when you go to college. Hopefully that you're not just putting that in financial terms. I mean, the most important aspect of education isn't financial, but the financial aspect is certainly there. And what may surprise people is I just want to come down thunderously to say, I think there are very, very few situations in which it is prudent to take out any kind of significant debt for education. I think it is very, very risky. And I think in the long run, it is more likely to bring harm rather than benefit into an individual's life. And I'll tell you why. Debt itself is a very difficult thing to overcome. I mean, you just look at the way debt is structured. To come out of a very young phase of life, entering into a career or a profession, and to have that enormous amount of debt that can easily accumulate and can easily be rationalized for education, that can come crushing down on a life. It can come crushing down on the life of a young couple. It can come crushing down on the life of an individual. And when we start talking about the reasons why, for instance, people aren't getting married at ages like they should be, I believe, and why they're delaying childbearing and all the rest, I think that has a lot to do with it. As a Christian, I know there are an awful lot of young Christians who ought to be on the mission field somewhere. They ought to be doing something for the cause of the Great Commission, but because of a crushing load of debt, they really can't do that. Now, I have two things to back up and make sure I make clear. Number one, I'm not suggesting that you do not get that education. I'm suggesting that there are all kinds of ways to get a good quality education that do not require you to sink your own financial ship. They should not. And, you know, you just start looking at the cost of some institutions and you realize, yes, my child would like to attend that institution, but there's no way we can actually do that, or it can bring either an enormous exposure to debt into our lives and into the child's life, or it can bring, for that matter, an enormous hardship on the family. I can tell you there are good educational values out there. But there are opportunities and alternatives to what many people would conceptualize and just imagine right up front as the obvious place for either a student to go or for a parent to send. And I would just encourage you to look around at the alternatives and recognize that the world's a big place. And here in the United States, one of the things we should be thankful for is that there are all kinds of educational opportunities. I'm far more concerned with you as Christians finding a place that is ideologically, worldview, healthy for your child. And then you put all that together. And as you evaluate institutions and evaluate alternatives, a lot of things will come to mind. Now, I also want to say that as I began the answer, I said there are a few situations in which that's justified. Let me tell you what one of those situations might be. For example, someone had the opportunity to go to medical school and medical school costing a certain amount of money. Almost everyone going to medical school has to take on a certain amount of indebtedness. And if in a certain professional context like this, on the other side, there's already a very clear understanding of how that's going to be managed and how that's going to be handled. If we only sent to medical school the people who could afford to go to medical school, I don't think we'd have many doctors. So there are some exceptions to this rule, but that's not where most students are. That's not where most people are making this decision. And even where something like medical school is the focus of attention, there might be other alternatives as well. I mean, I know people well who got their medical degree as they were in an ROTC program and entered into military service. And so both the individual and the society and the military benefited from that kind of program. So just be really careful. You know, I'm not Dave Ramsey. I'm not a financial advisor. I don't pose as one. I am a theologian, and I do know how to add. And I can tell you that debt adds up to a big problem. And so I'm just going to suggest that in almost any situation where debt can be avoided, it should be. And especially when it comes to education, be very, very careful. Let's go to Jeff calling from Tampa, listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Jeff.
Dr. Mueller, it's a pleasure and honor to talk to you. Real quick question regarding birth control. As a Christian, as a member of a Southern Baptist church from the South, I've done quite a bit of research, and I can find how many methods are, you know, should not be used regarding the pill and hormonal things and what's not okay. What I'm having trouble finding is there anything that is okay and acceptable as a form of birth control?
Jeff, God bless you for asking the question. Let me tell you, one of the problems in modern evangelicalism is that too few people are even asking the question. This really caught us unawares. And I do a lot of talking and speaking about this. I've written a lot about it. And if you go to my website at albertmueller.com and just put in birth control or contraception, you're going to get a flood of material. But I'm not just going to punt and say, go do that. I want to tell you there's certain things I want to just set down, even in the brief time we have before we have to go into a break. I am thankful you're asking the question. Too many evangelicals really fail to see there's a great moral and spiritual question to be answered here. I want to say, first of all, that we can't join the contraceptive revolution and just see the secular logic of birth control pills and all the rest is acceptable. You know, we don't consider children to be a disease we want to be vaccinated against. And there's a real moral danger in seeing children as a commodity you just decide to have. There's something about marriage and the conjugal union of the man and the woman and the gift of sex that is to imply procreation. Now, I'm not saying that a Christian couple can never use birth control of any kind. But we can't buy into the idea that birth control should just be the natural thing to do. The birth control is just justified just because it exists. That's not true. It's not true of any technology, certainly one that gets to the very heart of what it means to be human, as does birth control. We have to see children as divine gifts, as gifts of God to be welcomed under any circumstance, and not to be seen as some kind of pestilence that we want to be without and we want to take a pill to avoid. There are real abortifacient worries about hormonal birth control, Jeff, when it comes to the pill and to some other hormonal agents of birth control. And for that reason, I'm not a doctor. I stipulate that. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a pharmacist. But I can read, and I know what's going on. I know the physician's desk reference for most of these lists a potential abortifacient effect. And as one who believes in the sanctity and dignity of every single human life at every stage of development, I'm going to say I can't go that way without really, really ensuring that there is no abortifacient risk to whatever birth control method I may be choosing. So the bottom line is I think there are birth control methodologies and technologies that are lower risk. Barrier methods are the lowest risk of all, just to make that very clear, Jeff. So using barrier methods, a condom and other things, that's the lowest risk. And, of course, I'm talking here about a married couple. Let's be clear about that. We're not talking about facilitating sex outside of marriage. But we're talking about a couple, a Christian couple, trying to be good stewards to glorify God in every dimension of their lives, including their sexuality and procreative life and reproductive expectations. I think it's all really important. Now, I would suggest, just because there's no way I can say as much here as I would want to say, and even when I speak about this in church settings and elsewhere when it's appropriate, it takes a while to kind of lay this out, but I've done the best job I can to put this stuff into writing, and you'll find it at albertmueller.com. There are also entire programs dedicated to this, Jeff, which I think we can make available as you go to the website for today's program. We'll put some links up to where we've discussed this more thoroughly before. God bless you for asking the question. And I tell you what, Jeff gave us all a gift by calling and asking that question. What's your question? I guarantee you, I'm not the only one that wants to know. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with more.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome back to Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Mohler Program. I published a major article at my website today. The website is, of course, albertmohler.com. That's M-O-H-L-E-R.com. The title of my article is Truth Really Plural? Postmodernism in Full Flower. It's a review of a new book by John Franke, a professor at Biblical Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania. His new book is entitled Manifold Witness, The Plurality of Truth. And we're going to be talking about this later this week because it's one of those arguments that suggests something very cunning and subtle, and that is that truth can be more than one thing, that truth is inherently plural. And that is one of those things that opens up an entire postmodern world because it really subverts any effort to say that Christianity is this and not that, that the gospel is this and not that. It undercuts our ability to speak about truth in any way that is more than a constant negotiation between the culture and the biblical text and all the rest. You'll find my engagement with and a review of the book at albertmohler.com. It's a pretty lengthy article. And if you're concerned with what's happening in the church and in the so-called emerging church or the emergent church, that'd be a good place to look. The phone number for Ask Anything Wednesday is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Ozark, Missouri. Lane's listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Lane.
Yes, Dr. Mohler. I'm curious. I've been monitoring and following the multi-site church and studying even for our own church some. And one of the primary arguments really that opposes it is the understanding in the book of Acts that one of the essentials or essences of the church is their being together principally in one location, and mostly the my understanding is in Acts 9, I believe it's 30 or 31, where the use of the word ecclesia is given is the one allowance potentially for that interpretation. But I'm just curious as to your understanding of that, and also when they say being biblically faithful to the text versus the mandate of the Great Commission to reach people, those seem to be pitting themselves against one another. How would you advise to reconcile those two?
Yeah, Lane, what a good set of questions. And by the way, we had a fascinating discussion of these issues and a panel discussion here at Southern Seminary yesterday, and had a really good crew of folks here to talk about it. And you'll find a link to that. We're going to put up, you can find the video and the audio with today's program. We're going to put that up. And very interesting discussion. And some of the very issues that Lane just brought out came out in that discussion. And I'll tell you, the issue of taking the book of Acts, and by the way, we don't take the entirety of the New Testament, but in specific, the book of Acts, and figure out exactly how that fits here, well, that leads to some challenges. Not impossible, though. That's what we're obligated to. If we are going to be regulated by Scripture, then we're going to have to come to terms with what the Scripture sets out here. And so, Lane, as much as I can try to just kind of summarize what I would say in response to this, it is that I think classically, when you think of the church, you think of the church gathered together. You think of the church in one place. We have to be really careful, though, that we do not practice anachronism, which means that we do not assume that what we see and what we experience has always been normative. For instance, when you look at the book of Acts, when these churches often gather together, there's no reference to a building. So they were gathering together. One reference is to gathering together at Solomon's portico or Solomon's porch there at the temple. So evidently there was at least even an almost outdoor gathering of the church gathered together in one place. Obviously, in the early history of the church, you had house churches that may have grown larger. They may have met in larger assemblies, may have met outdoors. It's really hard to say because I'm going to be honest, as much as I want to be completely faithful to the book of Acts and figuring all these things out, we're given a whole lot more than some people want to admit, but we're not given as much as our questions might reach when we think about how to actually organize the church and its ministries. Lane, I'll tell you, I think, as I see it, trying to put this together in terms of a New Testament ecclesiology, I think there's an acceptable range of innovation and adaptation, and then we got to figure out what's outside that range. I'm very concerned about churches that, for instance, would have video presences elsewhere, which I think really robs the preaching of the word from its authenticity, having a preacher and a flesh and blood preacher there doing the preaching. I'll tell you, though, where there's no word at all in terms of evangelism, yes, I'm glad for people to hear an authentic, faithful, biblical message, whatever the medium. But when we are organizing the church, we're not just trying to say, all right, what could we get away with? We're trying to say, how do we show the church in its fullness? How do we live out the church in its fullness? If you decide to have separate services, as most churches in large cities have, then it's more or less the same decision as having different services in different places. There needs to be some opportunity for the church to gather together. I think that's very, very clear. Whether it's for every service with everyone in the room, I think it's where we really need to struggle with it even further. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We'll be back with more on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to Ask Anything Wednesday in the Albert Mueller Program. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We have good questions coming in from email and Twitter and Facebook. We'll get to as many of those as we can. But we're giving priority today to calls. Let's go to Josh, listening on the World Wide Web, calling from Arkadelphia, Arkansas. Go ahead, Josh.
Hey, Dr. Mueller, thanks for taking my call. I've been taught dispensational premillennialism.
Yeah.
And heard you talking a couple of weeks ago about historic premillennialism. And where would be a good book to do some reading on that? I've got Danny Aiken's Systematic Theology book, and Russell Moore wrote about that, but he kind of gives an overview of the different views. Where would be a good place to start?
Russell Moore, often serves as the guest host of this program and as senior vice president and dean of the School of Theology here at Southern Seminary. He did contribute to that book, wrote a great chapter on eschatology. I think he would probably define his position as a modified dispensationalism, more classically. I hold to a historic premillennialism, and those are very compatible positions. We're happy to teach together, happy to worship together, happy to be on the same teaching team in a local church together. But I do think historic premillennialism is the most natural understanding from the biblical text. And so I would suggest to you, Josh, just in terms of reading, there's a New Testament scholar now deceased by the name of George Eldon Ladd. That's L-A-D-D. He wrote a book entitled The Presence of the Future. Very good book. I would suggest to you, just looking at the book of Revelation, looking at Greg Beale's commentary. That's B-E-A-L-E. Good stuff. We put some links up to these resources. Also, there's a book, and this is one of these fun books, and I love doing these. I'm actually writing in one myself for Zondervan right now. They're called Five Views books. Sometimes they're not five books, five views. They're four, but nonetheless, The Meaning of the Millennium. That's a very interesting book. You read The Meaning of the Millennium, and I believe it's in that book that George Eldon Ladd actually presents the premillennial, historic premillennial position. And then there are other alternative positions, and the fun thing about those books is that the authors engage each other. They respond to each other. It's like having a seminary course in the covers of a book. It's a lot of fun, and I think you could find some really good stuff there, Josh. And I appreciate your call. Appreciate you listening to the program. That really excites me. You got a caller who says, I was listening, and it made me think, and now I want to read about it. And when you're thinking about how to exercise the Christian responsibility of the intellect and how to grow and mature as Christians, you know, that's just phenomenal. You hear about something, you start thinking about it, you realize the biblical significance of it, and you say, all right, I'm going to go read on that. Josh is a good example for us there. Thanks for your call, Josh. Let's go to State College, Pennsylvania, where Regina's on the line. Go ahead, Regina.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
I'm glad to hear from you. What's on your mind?
Yes, I have a question. I vaccinate my children, and I have a little concern about the vaccinations I've been hearing that are derived from aborted fetuses. What is your view on that?
Well, I think it's very problematic, Regina, but I'll tell you, in terms of what is currently available in terms of vaccines in North America, there is very little complication from the cells of aborted fetuses. And yet you have to go backwards and say, how do we get here? Most of these vaccines are derived from cell lines and serum lines that have existed now for decades. For instance, when they're making these flu vaccines, whether it's H1N1 or what they now we just kind of call the normal flu, it comes around every year, that virus is mutating all the time, but they don't go back to ground zero. They're actually using some biological materials that had existed before, and that's actually important to the process. It's far more effective, and again, I'm not a pharmacist, but I'm told it is far more effective and saves lives to go back and use these pre-existing biological material lines. Now, what happens is that somewhere back there was an original biological donor. And that's where the problem is, Regina. You're really looking at the fact that somewhere back there, someone did what I believe was fundamentally wrong and used some cells. I don't know how much, but they used some cells from aborted fetuses. By the way, in Europe right now, that's considered no big deal. In most European countries, that's just no big deal at all. As a matter of fact, there are collagen compounds used in cosmetics in many European countries that routinely use biological materials from aborted fetuses. I think that's abhorrent. It's almost unimaginable to me. And tomorrow or Friday on this program, we're going to be talking about the fact that there is now a cosmetic product line here in the United States that is also explicitly using a material from aborted fetuses. But when it comes to the vaccines, Regina, the best I know to say is that you're now looking at no way to go back and restart that process. That's where it was. It's kind of like where we are with the Nazi medical experiments. It's not legitimate to bless those Nazi medical experiments. They were abhorrent. They broke every principle of medical ethics. They're simply horrifying. But there is knowledge that came from them that is now used in modern medicine. That doesn't justify what happened, and it doesn't lessen our responsibility to condemn what happens. But there's actually no way now to go back and undo that from the totality of medical knowledge as it has expanded since, say, 1945 and the fall of Nazi Germany. It's impossible, literally, to go back and decontaminate modern medical knowledge from some of the illegitimate sources of that knowledge. And it's the same way with the virus and the serum. It's impossible now to go backwards and undo all of that. So, Regina, one of the things I'm saying to you is that it's not just about the vaccines. It's really about almost every aspect of medicine. There's going to be some complication like this. And so when you realize that, you have to say, well, it will be wrong intentionally to use the vaccine because it includes this. But I do think it's allowable, Regina, to go ahead and vaccinate your children using these vaccine lines, these serum lines, that now cannot be undone from what is now a very diluted presence of biological material that could indeed, if you could do the DNA study, be traced back to cells drawn from an aborted fetus. It's a reminder to us of how we live in a fallen world, Regina. And when I think about what this means for us, it's just a reminder that all of creation is groaning for the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. In the meantime, almost every technology we use has some kind of ethical complicity. The Christian principle to keep in mind here is that it is wrong to do anything to further that moral culpability. If it led to any other use of cells from an aborted fetus, if it led even more fundamentally to the abortion of even one baby anywhere on this planet, then it would be wrong to do it. But if that is not the effect, and if it was not the intention, and if there is no way to undo the good from the bad in this case, to take an absolute purist position would mean we can almost use no modern medicine at all. And I don't think that's where Christian moral wisdom would have us land. Thanks so much for your call. I love a call from a committed mother who's even worried about this. That's very good news for us all. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. Let's go to New Milford, Connecticut. Ellie's on the line, listening on the web. Go ahead, Ellie.
Oh, hi, Dr. Moeller. Thanks for taking the call. I had a question in response, biblical response to the question. What is your take on women preaching the word if there are no men qualified to do so?
Very interesting question, and with time running out, let me just say that there are all kinds of circumstances in which you find yourselves thinking thoughts and asking questions based upon urgencies. Just remember that just as bad cases make bad law, and or hard cases make bad laws is often the case, questions of exigency, as they're called in theology, or questions of urgency often lead to very, very unwholesome principles. And that's where we need to step back and say, the Bible's very clear about how the teaching should be done in the church. So one of the questions is, do you have a church until the Bible way of ordering the church is actually met? That's a very interesting question. So let's put it this way. What you need in a situation like that, Ellie, is to pray that God will send men so that you can establish the church, men who are qualified and ready to teach. Under extraordinary circumstances, all kinds of things happen. And right now, for instance, I can tell you one of the heroes and heroines of the faith for me is Lottie Moon. Lottie Moon sometimes ended up teaching in situations where she didn't believe she should be, but no one else was there to teach. But she was very clear that she would not do that in any ongoing pattern, and it was a way of holding the rope till some man could get there. And she prayed the most incredible prayers, in which she prayed for God to make men rise up to do what he had called them to do. She didn't preach in a church. Don't get me wrong. She wasn't doing that. But even in other teaching circumstances, she felt that a man ought to do it, and she shamed men eventually into doing it. What a shameful thing for men that this question would even arise. It's just a sign of confusion and the abdication of male responsibility in the church. But the question for us should not be what can we get away with, but how can we maximize the glory of God in the church? And that is very clear. I think the New Testament is just abundantly clear that the teaching assignment is to men who are qualified and recognized by the church as having that responsibility and set apart for that task and accountable to the Lord Jesus Christ for the task of teaching his flock. And it's kind of like asking the question as to if you're drowning, do you want a man or a woman to throw you the life ring? That's different. That's a situation you're glad to get the life ring. But if you're questioning who you would hire as a lifeguard under that situation, well, that could be very different. But we're not talking about hiring a lifeguard. We're talking about assigning someone to preach and teach the word. That's an even greater stewardship, and it's one to which the Bible clearly speaks. You'll find writings about that and so many other things on my website at albertmiller.com. We'll meet you tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.